Welcome to the chat room, the podcast on humanitarian action. My name is Anne Tritschler. I am a communications manager at the Center for Humanitarian Action. On day two of the CHAR conference 2024, Shashwat Zaraf was our guest on the panel about fragility, conflict, and violence in the face of climate change. Shashwat is a regional emergency director with the International Rescue Committee, or IRC, in East Africa. Shashwat has been working in the humanitarian sector since 1998, first in his home country, India, and later on internationally, for example, as regional director for Asia with Action Against Hunger and as country director in Afghanistan, Ethiopia, Somalia, Nepal, Jordan, Iraq, and Nigeria. Shashwat, thank you so much for joining us in the chat room studio.
Thank you for having me.
You have been working closely on the intersection of conflict and climate, and you are an expert for social inclusion and social accountability within humanitarian responses. And this is also what we want to talk about today. Before we dive into that, let's start from the beginning. What brought you to humanitarian action? What was your path?
So in some ways, actually, my entry into the humanitarian sector was an accident. In college, when we were all exploring what career path would we take and where would we go, I was actually quite interested in doing theater. I used to do semi-professional theater, do street theater. And I thought that it would be a wonderful life to do theater as a career. But then got into an institute called the Institute of Rural Management in Gujarat in India. And it's a 2 years master's program, which was actually built or crafted to cater to the management skills required in rural areas with farmers and with cooperatives. So it was a management institute, but catering to the rural and agrarian community rather than urban and multinationals, etc. And I spent about 6 months over 2 years in villages doing project work as part of my postgraduate program. Mm. I knew that this is the path I want to take. This is what I want to do. I want to spend more time in rural areas. I want to work on social inclusion, because during those 6 months, I recognized, I started to appreciate how there are multiple fractures in the Indian society, and there is a need for all of us to play our part. I think in many ways, the final straw on the camel's back was the fact that I was in one of the villages, and I was speaking to one of the village elders, and he basically told me that, "You are good in the field when it doesn't seem like you have grown up in an urban area. You have been able to adapt well to the village lifestyle, and you should just stay with us." And I told him, "I will do that." And I think that's my path. That's how I got into working in the humanitarian and development field.
Okay, so starting from there in the village, you have now been working in the humanitarian sector for 25 years. What are some of the biggest changes that you've seen over the course of your career in terms of how aid is provided?
So there have been many changes over the last 25 years. Just to highlight a few key changes that I feel have been critical. The first one is around the centrality of protection. I think there has been a lot of focus, emphasis on work that has gone in terms of making sure that communities, people, individuals, and particularly children and women are protected. We've brought centrality of protection to the core, right in the front of all our humanitarian work. The other massive shift has been the use of cash in programming. I think over the last decade or so, the appreciation of the fact that communities and people themselves need to choose what they want and what they want to do with the resources has engineered us to move towards more multipurpose cash programs. Now, rather than trying to manage logistics of big water and sanitation programs or food distributions, we are increasingly seeing that individuals, households, and communities are making choices, and they decide as to how the money that is transferred directly to them is used for themselves and their family, which is, again, a very important part of how we've been able to also promote accountability in terms of our own programming and response. The other big shift that we've seen is the localization phenomena. I think we have started to make strides to make sure that we recognize the importance of local responders, of both community responders, but also local NGOs that are first to respond in the wake of any crisis. But I still feel that there is a long way to go. We have started to talk about it. It has become an important point of our dialogue, our humanitarian dialogue. But we still need to make a lot more progress in terms of keeping the promises that have been made over the years to bring local actors and community-based organizations right at the center of all humanitarian work. I think some of the changes that have also impacted the aspect of sovereignty with respect to humanitarian space. I'm still a bit divided in terms of how to look at it in positive light, where the state and the governments play a critical role in determining how humanitarian aid, how humanitarian resources are used, vis-a-vis looking at it as barriers to independent, neutral, impartial humanitarian assistance to populations in need. And I think we've seen it both ways in different contexts, where the aspect of state and state exercising its authority over humanitarian assistance has been useful in state's own legitimacy and its own social contract with its citizens. But at the other hand, on the other hand, it has also resulted in multiple layers of administrative barrier, leading to impartial and more, I would say, an environment with multiple barriers to effective humanitarian assistance. So I think that's again a shift that we are seeing, and we will probably see more of as we go along. The context themselves have also changed and transformed quite a bit. Increasingly, we are seeing protracted crises. We see crises that continue to stretch from 1 year to 2 years to 5 years to 10 years to 20 years. And we continue to provide humanitarian assistance for decades rather than for a short term, which the intention has always been that humanitarian assistance is limited in time, is to alleviate suffering and save lives in a short term. But the protractedness of some of the crises, such as Somalia or Sudan, have actually resulted in humanitarian assistance continuing for a much longer period. On the other hand, what we are also seeing is context which are very political, and the scale and the severity of the crisis is a lot bigger than what we were used to earlier. So if we talk about the crisis in Ukraine, or if we talk about the crisis in Sudan today, or if we talk about the crisis in Palestine today, the severity, the scale have been pretty challenging and daunting for the humanitarian architecture. The capacity for us to be able to respond to multiple crises at the same time of such scale and severity has been pretty challenging and daunting.
These are already many points, and you also mentioned social inclusion and also social accountability, which you are an expert for. Maybe you can explain a little bit more. Why is this so important in humanitarian responses, and what does it mean in practice?
We know that society is not homogeneous. We have men, women, different ethnic groups. We have different caste groups. We have different tribes. We have different nationalities. In many ways, I think the society is very diverse. And in any humanitarian response, whether it's in Somalia, whether it's in India, or it's in Kenya, or it's in Indonesia, or it's in Nigeria, we do see the diversity in the communities that we are engaging with, that we are providing support to. And we also realize that diversity in many ways brings in a power dynamics, and any society has power dynamics and power structures. It's very vital for us to ensure that we understand the power structures, the power dynamics within a society, within a community, but also within a household. And I think that understanding and appreciation of power structures enables us to understand populations that are more at risk, that are more vulnerable. And that's why the need for us to focus on social inclusion, on making sure that people whose voices are normally not heard, or populations or groups that normally don't have a voice in a particular society or a particular community structure, are heard and are included in humanitarian assistance. Otherwise, in many ways, humanitarian assistance can continue to reinforce the existing power structures and continue to exclude people who are already excluded. That's the importance of social inclusion.
Now, but what can humanitarian organizations do exactly in practice to make these voices heard and to also adapt their programming to these voices?
First and foremost, I believe, is the understanding of the voices that are loud and the voices that are not loud. Understanding it enables us to ensure that we focus and we put in more effort to reach out to populations and groups that don't have a voice in a particular community setting. The second is about that proactive engagement leading to a program design and prioritization of our response based on the voices that we have heard from communities that are often excluded, be it the elderly, be it the differently abled, or be it women in many societies or particular ethnic groups or caste groups. As I had mentioned, one of my learnings during my initial 2 years of post-graduation and me spending time in rural areas was the recognition and the realization of the caste structure in an Indian society and how particular castes were excluded from holding assets in decision-making bodies, were excluded from various social engagements which actually diminished their social capital. So that appreciation and recognition helps us to contribute, to engage in such a manner with communities through our humanitarian assistance that not only do we facilitate in building the economic, the financial capital of those communities, but also the social capital and the voice of the communities. So that's the important role that we need to play. In many ways, building back better rather than building back to where we had started before the crisis. In a similar vein, I would want to talk about accountability. I think it's essential that people who are at risk, who have been impacted because of a particular crisis, are at the center of and are driving humanitarian action. And I think that's the importance of us being accountable as humanitarians to the populations that have been impacted. There are different ways in which over the years we've seen the increased emphasis and focus on social accountability, whether it's complaints and feedback mechanisms that have been built over the years, whether it's about engaging with different groups to influence, inform the program designs that we implement, or it's to do with social audit process where groups of communities themselves audit your program and your assistance on the ground to ensure that what we are delivering, the assistance that we are providing, is in line with what populations need, and also is in many ways solidifying or contributing to their dignity in receiving humanitarian assistance, and is not depriving them of that dignity that is very essential in all humanitarian work.
In your current role now at IRC, you're working very closely on the intersection of conflict and climate. Could you tell us a little bit more about the relationship between the two and how climate change can be a driver for armed conflict?
If we look at the last International Rescue Committee's document, the watch list document for 2024, where we identify the top 20 countries where we feel or we believe the humanitarian situation would deteriorate, most of the countries identified in the top 20 watch list are countries which are at the intersection of climate crisis and conflict crisis. So there is an increasing intersection and overlap between climate and conflict crisis. Now, in terms of causality itself, I think it's a bit difficult to talk about cause and effect, whether climate actually is contributing and has a causal relationship with conflict or vice versa. But we have seen how climate crisis has resulted in increasing the vulnerability of populations in various contexts. We've also seen how there is an increasing conflict over resources, particularly natural resources. So if I take the example of the big, long-lasting Horn of Africa drought crisis, then we did see the impact of five failed rains on the pasture land, on agricultural land, on water resources. And I think that in itself starts to fracture the social capital within communities who have coexisted in many ways for centuries, who have practiced agriculture or pastoral livelihoods over centuries in harmony. But because of the massive reduction in natural resources and the pressure on practicing your livelihood for sustenance of your lives starts to impact that harmony, starts to fracture that society and that social capital. And that's where you start to see more conflict, particularly over natural resources, particularly in a lot of pastoral areas because of increased frequency of droughts. But I would say that in many ways, there are many more reasons and contributing factors that contribute to conflict, and not only climate being one of those factors that is a trigger to increasing conflict.
At the conference, you said that whereas humanitarian response is directed to humanitarian needs directly, climate adaptation or its financing often has this state-first approach, and that this actually leads to some sort of vicious circle. So your recommendation was that we actually shouldn't see political stability as an essential requirement for working on climate mitigation and adaptation, but rather work with the people, work with the communities, and do climate resilience work along with the humanitarian response work. So how could that look like in practice? Can you give us some examples?
So if we look at the work that has happened over the years in a context such as Somalia, which has seen conflict over the last few decades, we can already start to see how communities themselves have been able to cope even in light of a very long and a very severe drought crisis recently. So if we make comparison between communities and between the investment that has happened with communities in building resilience vis-a-vis communities where that investment has not been made in Somalia, we could clearly see the difference in terms of the way the communities have been able to cope and even support some of the other communities that have had to move from their places, their locations in search for pasture and water. So I think there is enough evidence from even contexts such as Somalia that investing in community resilience, irrespective of instability, enables communities to cope in wake of very severe climate crisis. I think our expectation that there has to be political stability for us to invest in resilience, to invest in climate adaptation, is a bit misfounded or unfounded, because there are mechanisms at the community level which enable communities to work by themselves irrespective of state structures. And they actually contribute to strengthening state structures at the local or regional level. So for us to wait for a context such as Somalia or a context such as Sudan to become completely stable before we start to talk about climate adaptation work, to invest in climate work, will only result in communities and people becoming more vulnerable and requiring a lot more investment in the future rather than what we require today.
But what would you say, how could that work in practice? How could this climate humanitarian nexus, how could this work?
We keep talking about the fact that we continue to box ourselves in humanitarian box, in a development box, in a climate box. And I think we do know that people who we work with, people who are impacted, do not box themselves in a climate box or in a development box or a humanitarian box. For them, it's about their lives. It's about livelihood. It's about access to basic services. And it does not matter whether we label it as development work or we label it as climate work. So in many ways, I think our own artificial boxing has to be broken down. We do talk about the continuum. We do talk about the continuum from working on preparedness, working on mitigation, to working on response, to working on recovery, development. But I think in practice, the way the funding and the aid architecture exists today, we have different funding mechanisms for humanitarian work. We have different funding mechanisms for climate work. We have different funding mechanisms for development work. I think both the donors and the humanitarian actors on the ground need to really come out of these silos and boxes. So the effort has to be done both from donors and the actors on the ground to break these boxes and work out of these silos and work on that continuum as the people and the communities themselves see.
I think that already leads pretty well to my last question. Let's have a look into the future. What do you wish or hope for regarding this future collaboration between the humanitarian and the climate communities?
I think the climate communities have a lot to contribute in terms of making sure that the voice is there, the appropriate policies are there, the appropriate global commitments are there, global, regional, national commitments are there. The constant churning of research, data, information, analysis is very critical for future climate adaptation work, and the climate communities have been at the front and center of that work. The humanitarians, on the other hand, in many ways have the added value of being with the communities on the ground, engaging in difficult contexts, in both hard-to-reach areas, but also in areas where people are impacted, and have a very strong relationship with the communities on the ground. I think both the climate communities and humanitarian communities need to take advantage of what the two communities have to offer. And that's why I think that's where we will break those silos, and we need to take from all the voice, the research, the analysis, and ensure that it does come to the ground and is used by farmers, by pastoralists, by others, rather than it being somewhere in the capitals of Europe or in the capitals of the country, rather than being in Garissa or in Baidoa or in Benishangul Gumuz. So I think the importance is about that connect and the added value, and recognizing the added value that the two communities bring together, and coming together to deliver assistance which is adapted and which is fit for purpose for the peoples that are impacted the most.
Thank you very much Thank you for being here today. And also thank you again for having joined us at the conference.
No, thanks to you. Thank you.
This is it today from the chat room, the podcast on humanitarian action. Today with Shashwat Saraf. You can find all relevant links to this session in the show notes. For example, a link to the recordings of all conference panels. If you have any feedback or suggestions, we're happy to hear. Just send us an email to info@charberlin.org. Thanks for listening.